election outcome was by and large representing the will of the people of Myanmar.
That finding deals a blow to the stated reason for Myanmar's junta. It's Tuesday, May 18th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, the U.S. places more sanctions on Myanmar's military. As NATO and U.S. troops leave, fighting intensifies in Afghanistan. Americans struggle over when and where to wear face masks. Controversy over flights carrying Australians from coronavirus hit India. Worldwide, more people are dying from overwork. It is all on today's VOA Asia. Myanmar's general election in November was by and large representing the will of the people, concludes the report of one of the few international observers that monitored the election in the country. Before the Myanmar parliament was supposed to seat for the first time since the vote, the military seized power in the early hours of February 1st, using claims of mass fraud in the vote to justify the coup. But Asian Network for Free Elections found no evidence that the irregularities would affect the overall outcome of the election. That according to Lee Chung Lun, who took part in the report.
The main issues that we found in this election was the election cancellation issues, the censorship of campaign speech of the political parties, as well as the persistent impression of bias of the UEC against opposition parties. But overall, it is NFRL's informed opinion that the election outcome was by and large representing the will of the people of Myanmar.
Lee said, yes, there was some evidence of fraud.
We observed some inconsistencies in the implementation of voting procedures and vote counting procedures, but the overall process was transparent, where the election observers and agents from political parties were able to monitor in the polling station to monitor the entire voting process and vote counting process. So we find no evidence that the irregularities would affect the overall outcome of the election.
The United States on Monday imposed fresh sanctions on Myanmar's junta, targeting the governing State Administrative Council and 13 officials in the latest in a series of punitive actions following a military coup. The Southeast Asian country, also known as Burma, has been in crisis since the military seized power from Aung San Suu Kyi's elected government on February 1st, with near daily protests and a crackdown by the junta in which hundreds of people have been killed. The U.S. Treasury Department, in a statement, accused the SAC, formed a day after the coup, of being created by Myanmar's military to support its unlawful overthrow of the democratically elected civilian government. You can find out more by checking our website at voanews.com, as well as all of our social media platforms. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. Trading on Hong Kong dissident Jimmy Lai's media company halted. Samoa poised to welcome its first female prime minister. COVID concerns forced cancellation of World Economic Forum 2021 annual meeting in Singapore. More COVID-19 vaccines coming to Taiwan as cases there spike. And the U.S. military offers J&J vaccines for South Korean troops. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Fighting between the Taliban and Afghan government forces resumed Sunday in the rest of southern province of Helmand, according to officials, ending a three-day ceasefire agreed to by the warring sides to mark the Eid al-Fitr holiday. Violence has soared as the United States military presses ahead with a plan to withdraw all of its troops by September, bringing an end to a 20-year military operation in Afghanistan. Clashes between the Taliban and Afghan forces erupted early on Sunday when the insurgents attacked security checkpoints in the outskirts of Lashkargah, the capital of Helmand province, according to the provincial council chief. An Afghan army spokesman in the south confirmed fighting had resumed as the three-day temporary truce ended late on Saturday. The Helmand governor's office said that 21 Taliban fighters had been killed in the morning fighting. Washington has vowed to end America's longest war, but missed a May 1st deadline to withdraw, agreed with the Taliban last year, in return for security guarantees and a promise to launch talks with the Afghan government. President Joe Biden pushed back the date to September 11th, exactly two decades from the terrorist attacks in the United States, which led Washington to invade Afghanistan and oust the Taliban. Happening now in Asia, a travel bubble between Hong Kong and Singapore, due to open on May 26th, has been postponed for a second time after a spike in cases in Singapore derailed the plan for quarantine-free travel between the financial hubs. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We are happy you're with us on VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Americans are grappling with the guidance by the CDC late last week that if they are fully vaccinated against the coronavirus, then for the most part they can go without a mask outside and inside. Michelle Quinn has more.
Just one-third of the U.S. population is fully vaccinated, and one-fourth consistently tells pollsters they don't plan to get one of the three available vaccines. So Americans, retailers, and health officials were surprised last week when the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said fully vaccinated individuals could go without face coverings, with a few exceptions. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky says the guidance is about individual responsibility.
If they're vaccinated, they are safe. If they are not vaccinated, they are not safe. They should still be wearing a mask or, better yet, get vaccinated.
Some public health leaders criticize the guidance as too abrupt and confusing, since it's not clear who is vaccinated. The Biden administration has said it won't create a national vaccine passport. The new CDC guidance has revived discussion around a vaccine card so that businesses and others know if people have been inoculated. Walensky says the guidance is not permission for widespread removal of masks, but for each person to take their health into their own hands. For the unvaccinated, the guidance hasn't changed, she said. Last week, U.S. President Joe Biden, appearing without a mask, alongside Vice President Kamala Harris, described the updated guidance as a great day for America. The CDC's guidance spurred change throughout the country, with some retailers dropping the mask requirement for vaccinated shoppers. Others say they will maintain their current rules as they review the guidance. A union representing 1.3 million food and retail workers said the guidance could put its members at risk.
What we're asking our businesses to do as they are starting to think about the guidance as to what this means for their workplaces is to make it easy for paid time off for their employees to get vaccinated.
Not all states are ready to loosen their rules, and masks and social distancing are still required on planes and other public transportation. Meanwhile, some states and businesses are coming up with novel ways to encourage people to get vaccinated, such as free train rides, pints of beer, and even money, as they try to return their communities to normal. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. With VOA Asia, also follow radio program hosts VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. India's electricity use fell 6.2% during the first half of May compared with the second half of April, according to government data, as coronavirus lockdowns imposed by states across the country stifled power demand. All of the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia, Twitter, and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. The first repatriation flight carrying Australians from coronavirus-hit India after the lifting of a two-week travel ban arrived in Darwin over the weekend. The government in Canberra has said the controversial measure has worked, but it has been condemned by rights groups. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Passengers hoping to fly from India home to Australia must return a negative COVID-19 result on two tests before they can board a repatriation flight. The Qantas plane from Delhi to Australia's Northern Territory Saturday was only about half full. About 80 people were on board. Others were turned away after either testing positive for COVID-19 or being in close contact with someone who contracted the virus. Those allowed to return will have to quarantine at a former mining camp at Howard Springs in the Northern Territory for 14 days. The repatriation flight marks the end of a controversial travel ban. Australians had been threatened with jail or a heavy fine if they returned home from India in breach of biosecurity conditions. The ban was condemned by some politicians, human rights groups, and the Indian diaspora as immoral and racist. Officials said it was necessary because of the high level of coronavirus infections among travellers returning from India, which was putting strain on Australia's mandatory quarantine hotel system. Prime Minister Scott Morrison says the travel ban has been effective.
That pause has done its job. The number of cases that we had up in Howard Springs at that time was over 50. It's now down to 4. So they're ready. Also around the country, we saw the number of those with active cases in quarantine fall from 292 to 171. So the system is ready to respond.
Up to 1,000 Australians are expected to be repatriated from India on official flights by the end of June. It's estimated that 10,000 Australian citizens, permanent residents and their families are stranded in India. Australia has taken a hardline approach to the pandemic. It closed its borders to most foreign nationals in March 2020 to curb the spread of the virus. A quarantine-free corridor with New Zealand is allowing unrestricted travel between the two neighbours. Australians wanting to leave the country must have government permission. Citizens and permanent residents can come home, but they face mandatory hotel quarantine when they arrive. About 30,000 coronavirus cases have been recorded in Australia since the pandemic began. 910 people have died, according to the health department. Mass screening has also been a key part in the country's COVID-19 strategy. More than 17.4 million tests have been carried out for a population of 25 million people. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Making headlines in Asia, China's State Council announced new laws halting the teaching of foreign curriculums in schools from kindergarten to grade 9 and prohibiting the ownership or control of any private K-9 schools by foreign entities. The laws are the latest in a series of measures taken by Beijing to tighten control of its fast-growing education sector. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a growing number of people around the world are dying from heart disease and stroke because of overwork. The new World Health Organization, International Labor Organization study says that. The study is based on data from more than 2,300 surveys collected in 154 countries from 1970 to 2018. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The study says those working at least 55 hours a week are at higher risk of dying from heart disease and stroke. In 2016, the data show 1 in 10 people around the world, or 450 million, worked excessively long hours, leading to 745,000 heart disease and stroke deaths. Frank Pega, a technical officer in WHO's Department of Environment, Climate Change and Health, says this is a 29% increase since 2000.
We know that this burden disproportionately affects men. 70% of all deaths from cardiovascular disease occur in men, according to our official estimates. Also, the regions that are most affected are Southeast Asia and the Western Pacific. And we can tell you that it appears that middle-aged and older workers are disproportionately burdened.
The study reports most recorded deaths are among those aged 60 to 79 who have worked for 55 hours or more per week. The lowest recorded number is in Africa, which has a young population. It says Europe and North America have the lowest occupational disease rates. It says this is because people in these regions are largely covered by employment protections that limit the number of hours they work. The new analysis highlights the impact the COVID-19 pandemic has on workers who increasingly are working from home. Pega says teleworking and the digitization of work appear to be speeding the trend toward long working hours.
We have some evidence that shows that when countries go into national lockdown, the numbers of hours work increased by about 10%. We also have a sort of massive increase in digitization of work, and digitization of work might actually make it harder to disconnect. Rest periods and personal periods might need to be scheduled when you're working online, right? Because otherwise you might be working very long hours.
Health and occupational safety officials urge nations to consider the well-being of their populations as the world enters the post-COVID recovery period. They say governments must ensure that recovery measures are not pursued at the expense of the health of workers. They say governments should introduce and enforce laws that ban mandatory overtime and ensure limits on maximum working times. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Bryce Wittstein is a 16-year-old skateboarding prodigy from California and one of Team USA's main hopes for a gold medal in Summer Olympics 2021. Maxime Moskalkov spoke with Bryce and her mother, Donna Wittstein, about the upcoming Olympics and the passion for sports.
Skateboarder, surfer, student, songwriter. That's how 16-year-old California native Bryce Wittstein describes herself on her website. Since she was 13, Wittstein has been a rising star of the U.S. women's skateboarding team. She started skateboarding when she was only 5, but it seems she already knew it would be her life.
One time where my dad told me he was going to go skateboard in a pool somewhere, and I said, I kind of knew about skateboarding, and I was like, what do you mean you're going to go skateboard in a pool? And it ended up not being a pool that you swim in, but a pool that was drained of water, and it was actually a pool that you can skateboard in. And the whole time I'm just thinking, this can't be real. This isn't really happening.
Before dedicating her life to skateboarding, Bryce tried dancing, gymnastics, basketball, volleyball, and surfing. But it was skateboarding that became her true passion.
It's always there to captivate you. It's kind of like your other half in a way. And I realized that everywhere I've went, it's never the same thing every day.
For Bryce's father, Max, a pilot by profession, skateboarding has always been just a hobby. Bryce's mother, Donna, wasn't too happy her daughter took up skateboarding. Too dangerous.
I wasn't really that stoked. I was glad that she was doing it, but I wanted her to experience a bunch of other things as well, dancing.
Today, Bryce has her own ramp in her backyard. Her father spent 6 years and at least $25,000 to build it for her. Many say competitive skateboarding is similar to figure skating and gymnastics, a demanding physical activity with stunts and a panel of judges that assess performance. But Bryce says it's a very inspiring sport where one needs a lot of creativity as well.
Judges don't always judge on how difficult it is or the exact precise thing, because like when you're skateboarding, there's this element of innovativeness that everybody brings to this tabletop.
Wittstein also is passionate about objecting to the stereotype that skateboarding is more suitable for men than women.
When girls are skating, they never have to look to someone else or try to fit.
Coming definitely from
Bryce's dream to make it to the Olympics is about to come true this July. She is one of Team USA's hope for a gold medal at the Tokyo Games.
If I ever got on the podium of the Olympics, honestly, I never have any words for it, because I think a lot of times you could just see that the tear ducts would unwrap and you just start crying.
But win or lose, Wettstein says taking part in the Olympics is the most important part for her. Maxim Moskalko for VOA News, Washington.
We continue on VOA Asia. Washington, D.C. has launched a new program called Green Boats. It's part of an innovative new program designed to clean up the Anacostia River, which flows through part of the U.S. Capitol. Licia Bacalez has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
An early Saturday morning in May. Plenty of volunteers have showed up despite the drizzle and unusually cold weather to clean up the Anacostia River in Washington, D.C.
I actually live in this neighborhood, and I spent a lot of time exploring this area around Kingman Island over the past year during the pandemic, and I've seen a lot of trash here, unfortunately, on the river.
These people are volunteers in the city's Green Boats program. They can rent a boat or kayak for free to travel along the Anacostia River, as long as they collect trash as they go. Each of the craft holds two volunteers. They are accompanied by rangers and instructors from the American Canoe Association. There's only one main rule: no standing.
We go over the basics of litter capturing, and so we provide people with grabbers and maybe some nets. And as people are reaching out to pick trash out of the water, we ask them to, you know, keep your balance and then fill up their bags.
Most of the trash is on the riverbanks, but it's next to impossible to reach these spots on foot. That's why the D.C. Department of Energy and Environment decided to organize these trash-collecting boat trips. But the idea is not unique. It came to the United States from Europe.
I was at a climate conference in Copenhagen, and they had different programs all around the city, and I was riding a little, you know, a little electric scooter by their harbor, and I saw these green kayaks with a big sign, you know, saying, you know, come look at this. I went and looked at it and thought, what a great idea that they have people go out into the harbor, pick up trash, bring it back in a bucket, and bring the boat back.
Today, the Green Boats program is operating in five European countries, and volunteers have collected over 42 tons of trash. Washington, D.C. is hoping for the same effect. For Lesa Bokalets in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Each year in Hong Kong, in the lead-up to Buddha's birthday, turtles are released into the wild through a practice known as mercy release. Conservationists say the superstitious practice could be doing more harm than good. More from Reuters' Flora Bradley Watson.
In Hong Kong, thousands of marine animals are freed every May in the lead up to Buddha's birthday. The practice, known as mercy release, is believed to bring good fortune to people. However, the good intentions of the superstitious can often result in more harm to the animals than good. Many of them are intentionally captured and sold just to be set free. They can get hurt and be left stranded in murky waterways where they normally don't belong. Sean Lai is the founder of Hong Kong Abandoned Tortoise Concern Group. He warns that releasing turtles in catchwater drains or ponds can kill them.
If they used to be cared for by humans, they won't be able to hunt in the wild. They may not be able to catch the fish, shrimp, or food they need, and then they'll starve to death. Or due to the change of weather, they might freeze to death or die from the heat.
Lai and his group of volunteers snorkeled through muddy waters to save dozens of turtles left there by residents. They're now nursing more than 60 injured turtles in their homes. While mercy release is not illegal in the city, authorities say the practice can spread diseases and poses a risk to ecosystems. Paul Crow is senior conservationist at Kodori Farm and Botanic Garden.
One is just directly ecosystems that are receiving non-native animals can be changed by the arrival of those animals if they manage to survive. Potential disease, bacteria, virus, parasites from other countries, from the collection source, are all getting dumped without screening or without sort of consideration of the public health risk as well.
Other animals commonly involved in mercy releases in Hong Kong include frogs, insects, baby birds, and fish.
Flora Bradley Watson reporting. You've been listening to VOA Asia. Thank you for joining us. Thanks to our service chief, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Doug Bernard, Amy Heibels, Jim Stevenson, and Keith Lane. I'm Ira Melman. Enjoy the day ahead and stay safe.